Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, this is the second of our podcasts that we recorded at Opera Holland Park last Saturday. Our first live event for 18 months. Fantastic. Opera Holland Park in West London lent us there. Beautiful venue, outdoors, spectacular place, wasn't it, Dave? Under canvas.
It's one of those places where people walked in and they were immediately kind of enchanted because it wasn't like any other gig or concert hall that you've been to before, really, because it was all separate items of furniture you were sitting on, chairs and, you know,
lovely old chairs,
almost sofas, you know, and there were people on the front row who were so comfortable, you know. If you pay for the premium tickets, you got on the front row, which is literally, that is the best seat in the
house. And there they were with their bottles of wine and their grapes, you know, and their food. It was wonderful.
Absolutely.
But we had four guests. We had Gary Crowley, we had Mark Lewison, we had Danny Baker. And our second guest was the fantastic writer, Leslie Ann Jones. And the four stories that she tells are flagged up at the beginning of this. But look out for farcical stuff about why it was impossible to lift John Entwistle's coffin at his funeral, and how his girlfriend ran off with the vicar. Knockabout movie waiting to be made there, starring Bill Nighy. And you have to hear about the pictures that were hung on Raquel Welch's wall. It's and good stuff on the stones too. It's fantastic.
Here you go.
Excellent. Fantastic.
Lovely.
So look, we've got to start with Queen at Live Aid, because you were telling us earlier that actually relationships...
Too small.
Yeah, should we stand? You're going to be all right.
We'll stand.
Are you there?
I'm too tiny. Hello, boys.
I'm worried it's going to fall over now.
Hello, boys.
you were telling us earlier that, which I had no idea, actually. Dave and I were at Live Aid, but we weren't allowed backstage.
No.
It was very exciting to be backstage with Queen. But the relationship between them was a bit frosty, and they were at the point of splitting up. Am I right in thinking that was the
case? You're right. It was like married couples divorcing at the same party. You know, that sort of frostiness that you get? And they were keeping their distance from each other. Complicated by the fact that Jim Hutton, who was Freddie's relatively new boyfriend, it was not only his first stadium gig, it was his first ever gig. So imagine Live Aid as your first ever.
He'd never been to a gig before.
Never been to a gig. He was a barber. And he'd cut David Bowie's hair, but David Bowie denied it. And this was when he was a barber at the Savoy. And Bowie used to circle around and say, "No, I've never met you before," but actually he had. But no, he'd never been to a gig. So
that would be a bit of a shock.
I think it probably was. Everybody's seen Bohemian Rhapsody, the film, I'm guessing. They show in the film that Freddie and Jim set off from Freddie's house in Kensington, just down the road from here, and they go to Freddie's mum and dad's house. And Freddie introduces Jim to his parents. Didn't happen. Absolutely didn't happen. I wasn't sure why they invented that.
It's filmed.
Because that is a lot to go on in one day, isn't it, if you think?
They took the same approach to the Second World War, really, didn't they?
You know, but you're going to meet your partner's mum and dad. Not only that, but they are of a very tight-knit religious group, and they're probably not going to be that welcoming, especially since you are also a man, and you've got the biggest gig in the world, the greatest stage you've ever played on. All of that in one day. It didn't ring true for me.
No.
They spent 3 weeks rehearsing for that, so they took it incredibly seriously, didn't they? I
mean, yeah, they did.
When they came off, did you get the impression that they knew that they'd completely cracked it? Because they kind of stole the day, really, didn't they?
No, they didn't. They were hardly talking, as I said. They had a secret thing that they did. And there was a flicker of this in the film. I spotted it. They had a sound guy called Trip Califf. And just before Queen went out on stage, Tripp went out, and you sort of see a hint of this. You see a finger pushing the lever like this. And this was a reference to the fact that the sound man went round to the front and he whacked the sound up. So when Queen went out on stage, they were louder than everybody else, to the point that everybody backstage stopped and looked at the monitor and said, who's that? And of course, in the film, they show what looks like Bono coming off stage just as Queen go on. Of course, it wasn't U2 who played before Queen. It was Dire Straits. But I don't know whether there was an argument with Mark Knopfler. I have to ask Ed Bittnell, actually, the manager. But I don't know what happened there.
So I've got to go through these four things that you talked about.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Rock and roll funerals.
Yeah.
Have you been to more than one or just one?
To the best of my knowledge, and things were sometimes hazy in the 80s and 90s, you have to understand. But as far as I remember, I only went to one, and it was John Entwistle. Bass player in the
And he was an old pal of yours, I think.
Yeah.
He had a place up in the Cotswolds,
he
right?
did. He had a house called Quarwood in Stow-on-the-Wold. And I'd got to know John when Gary and I were presenting a TV show in the way back when on Channel 4 called ESA. So we had lots of stars on the show and we became friends with them, as you did in those days. It seems hard to imagine now that journalists pretty much could become friends with artists, but we did. And so started hanging out with John. I was very friendly with his girlfriend, Maxine, a mad American. And they had crazy parties at their house. So there was a shark room at John's house, this room that was hung with sharks and marlin that John had caught himself. And then they were preserved in some way. So they all hung down from the ceiling. So that was, and the dare was to spend a night on your own in that room. And he collected suits of armour, teapots, chess sets.
Collected suits of armour?
Yeah.
So there were a number of
all
them.
Over the house.
So you're blundering around to the loo in the day, in the
That's
night.
Right. Did you ever wear them?
And I was about to say, sometimes you'd be plundering around for the loo in the middle of the night and you'd bump into a suit of armour and it would be John inside it. That was his shtick, yeah.
John Entwistle seems to me to be the classic case of somebody who was in a very successful rock band and making a lot of money, but had no real responsibility. The group were not looking to him to write the songs and keep the momentum up. He could just behave as riotously as he liked.
But he did, on stage, he just stood there. They called him the ox, didn't they? Because he just stood still. He barely moved a muscle apart from his fingers, his thunder fingers. And he was a very loud bassist. I think they had the record for playing the loudest rock gig ever. I think they broke a record at some point. But his
Give us the flavour of the funeral.
Who was the favourite of the funeral?
Give us a flavour.
Flavour, okay. So
tell us about the death that led to the funeral. Not that you were present at the time, but...
The death was the finest rock and roll death anyone could have had. So the Who were about to tour in America. They were in Las Vegas. They were in a motel. John had a favourite stripper who lived in Vegas, who he always called upon, let's say, when he was in town.
The old sentimental fool, hey?
Got a few quid off.
There's one in every port.
She looked different with the clothes on.
Yeah.
They tend to. And so he'd been partying with this girl, Alison. They'd done a load of coke. They'd gone back. They were in bed. He was up to here in brandy, under a hooker, and he died. He was 57. And everybody went rock
and
roll.
It's the way he would have wanted to go.
Rock and roll. His girlfriend wasn't that amused.
Were you surprised that he died?
Yeah, I was actually, because I didn't know at the time what a cokehead he was. I had no idea, because, you know, in those days, and my kids find this very hard to believe, they always say, oh, come on, Mummy, you did drugs. And we didn't. We drank an awful lot of champagne. That was the 80s. But we didn't do drugs. The people who did it concealed it from those of us who didn't do it. So actually, no, I didn't know, and I was surprised. The funeral was mayhem because, and I didn't know this before, anyone can go to anyone's funeral. So it's a public affair. Anyone can turn up, and everyone did turn up. There were hundreds of Who fans there. And they had a massive coffin. The coffin was, it must have taken about 5 trees to make it. It was a vast thing, and they'd underestimated what this thing was going to weigh, because John wasn't a small guy, if you remember. He was tall. And so they got John in the coffin, and they had the 6 pallbearers, and they couldn't lift it. to carry it into the church. And somebody had to drive back to the funeral parlor to get a trolley to put the coffin on the trolley. So everything was delayed while they went off to get this trolley. It's true. And then they came back, put it on the trolley. And then the pallbearers, this was amusing, they lined up either side of the coffin and then sort of shuffled in to make it look as though they were carrying it. So it was a bit of a carry-on film.
Farce, isn't it?
It was a farce. And then, of course, Pete Townsend and Roger came in at the last minute and they were very upset. Like, really, really upset. And then there was the wailing widow, which was Lisa Pritchett Johnson, who was John's girlfriend at that time, who he'd stolen from Joe Walsh and the Eagles. And John's mother,
from
Queenie.
Joe Walsh to John.
From Joe Walsh to John Hirschwitzel.
Frying pan fire.
This is sublime to the extra ridiculous that was. And then there was John's mum, Queenie, who was practically throwing herself on the coffin. I thought she was going to go in the grave afterwards, but they managed to keep her out. There was this very nice chap called Colin Wilson, the Reverend Colin Wilson, who conducted, officiated at the funeral. He was rather sweet, actually. He was especially sweet to Lisa Pritchett Johnson because they began an affair soon afterwards.
And so the grieving widow ran off with the vicar.
Okay.
It's good stuff, isn't it? Tom Sharp couldn't make this up, could he, really?
The press were all over Stow-on-the-Wold after this happened. You can imagine, the poor wife of the vicar and two little girls didn't know what hit them. And I remember they interviewed one of the neighbours on television, and she said, oh, he was such a nice man. He'd always come round and say, can I water your flowers or anything? Always ready to do whatever you wanted. And I thought, yes, I bet he was. He got defrocked eventually.
Dear oh dear.
And yeah.
That's extraordinary. Let's move on to David Bowie's holiday home, which I jokingly said was a chalet at in Rhyl or Filey or whatever. You borrowed David Bowie's holiday home. Tell us about this.
Yes, it's an Indonesian palace in on the Isle of Mystique. And I have a witness to the fact that we did go. My daughter, who's over there, was with me at the time. She was only a little girl. We stayed at David's house. I used to see David quite a lot in New York because back in the day, pre-internet, when I was working on Fleet Street, you couldn't just go online or Zoom anybody or do an interview in any way other than to go there. So we were always getting on and off planes. Every week you'd be going, some weeks twice to New York and back. I did a lot of Concorde flights in those days, and I was often in New York. And David was living in New York at that time. I used to bump into him. And he'd say, well, what are you doing? Do you want to have some lunch? Or do you want to have dinner tonight or whatever? So we did meet up quite often. And it was simply because David Bowie, also a Jones like me, he loved people from home. He was very London, if that makes sense. And he just liked hanging out with people from the old days because he was ordinary, which seems an extraordinary thing to say, but he just liked to be not a rock star. He liked to be just David Jones. And then he met Iman. Iman went, she is Somalian born. She didn't like the whole setup in Mystique because it's very much rich white people owning houses and poor black people being their servants. And that didn't appeal to her as a black woman. So she told him he had to sell it. So before he offloaded his house there, it was called Britannia Bay House in those days, he decided he was going to send all his friends out there to experience the place. So Mia and I went out, and I wrote the first draft of my first Freddie Mercury book in his house. We were sleeping in his bed with his view of St. Vincent and trying to soak up his DNA out of the mattress.
I'm going to say, because when you borrow a holiday home, you always see there's little signs all around the place of the people who own it or were last there, you know. And you can't stop being fascinated by, oh, look, the wellies are at the front door. Or was there anything like that at David Bowie's place?
There were his knickers. There was a drawer of knickers. In fact, maybe they were his. They were very frilly kind of female knickers. Right. So, I mean, maybe they were sort of ones that people borrowed when they stayed in the place. But there were some nice pictures of him, framed pictures around the place. It was very tasteful, very Balinese, very... it had taken a long time to design and build.
Right. Yeah. So you go back with David Bowie, don't you? Because you used to come and visit him at Haddon Hall, the famous squat in the early 70s, is that right?
No, it was a bit later than that. When we were at school, actually, no. The first time I went round there would have been the time Space Oddity came out. And David had been trying to give it away and couldn't for about 10 years, and then suddenly had a hit because the BBC used Space Odyssey as the soundtrack for the moon landings. And we were just little kids at school in Bromley, and he was down the road in Beckenham. So we used to get the 227 bus from the Market Square that he wrote about all the way down to Beckenham High Street, walk up South End Road and knock on his door, as kids do, and to get signed photos, you see. And I said to my friend Natasha, who I was at school with, one day Angie, his wife, she's going to be out and he's going to answer the door and he's going to have us in for tea. And that's what happened. And as ridiculous as that sounds,
I know.
I remember sitting there thinking, he had a silver ceiling and red bottle green furniture, red walls. It was like Christmas. The room was like Christmas. And he was wearing a lemon silk kimono and painting his fingernails with black polish with a cocktail stick because he'd lost the brush. And he was barefoot and very exotic. And I thought, I have to grow up and be with people like this. But how? You know, we were the kind of house that had lace neck curtains and crocheted toilet roll covers and that kind of thing. How was I going to do this? I wasn't artistic, I wasn't musical. But my dad, who'd been a footballer, was now a sports writer. And the pennies dropped. I suddenly thought, I can do that. I can go on the road with bands and write about them.
So how did you end up sharing a house with Raquel Welch?
In Atlantic City... years earlier, I had got to know a guy called Hal Lifson. He was a sort of Hollywood fixer type person. And he was managing LaToya Jackson at the time. And when I moved to Los Angeles, when I was on U Magazine for the Mail on Sunday, he said, give me a shout when you're in town. And I was staying at the Sunset Marquee Hotel for about 2 months, but you can't stay there forever. And he said, a friend of mine's looking for a housemate. In fact, somebody I look after. Oh, who's that? He said, have you heard of Raquel Welch?
Somehow the word housemate doesn't somehow work. This is the idea you're going to the laundrette together and a couple of glasses of wine.
It was a bit more than that, really, because Raquel was the most insecure person I'd ever met in my life. And really, I had a function, and that function was to make her feel good and to look good. So I had to call her Rocky, and she called me Baby. And she spoke in the third person always. And she'd say, does Rocky look good today, baby? Because a girl's got to know. And I'd have to lavish her with praise and attention and tell her how beautiful she was. And there were pictures all over the house of her, stark naked, in various sort of poses, life-size portraits. You could not... Her nipples followed you wherever you went. It was... It was disconcerting. We used to get our nails done.
This is a chronic psychological condition.
Yeah, I mean, I needed help. You know, I needed
counselling. But there
counseling.
Are some people who you know, they accept they have a level of celebrity and then keep the other side of their life completely private and act a certain way in public. But there are others that obviously just cannot survive without that kind of level of attention.
She needed. And she's one of them. Oh, yeah, she desperately needed. And her best friend was Nancy Sinatra. And they both...
So keep it grounded, wouldn't it?
You know. So we would go to the Beverly Hills Hotel and we would sit around the pool and we'd have our nails done and we'd go out to dinner. And, of course, they were always on. They were never not Raquel and Nancy. They were always stars. And my function was to make them feel like stars.
Yeah.
I was a lackey. I probably should have had psychological help when I got back from that. But, it follows me around.
So you've written books about Freddie Mercury, about John Lennon. What are you working on at the moment? Stones book are you doing?
Next year, July 2022, is the 60th anniversary of the Rolling Stones' very first gig at the Marquee Jazz Club on the 12th of July, 1962. So I'm writing a book called The Stone Age, covering their entire career and how we regard the Stones today, I guess, which is very different from how we thought about the Stones all those years ago.
Who's your favourite Stone?
Keith.
All right, simple.
Yeah.
Why?
I got a friend called Peter Myers, who was actually my dad's friend, my late dad's friend. He's got a grocery store on Hudson Street in Lower Manhattan. It's called Myers of Keswick, and it's a store that sells English foods to expats living in New York. So, and he makes pies on the premises, and the queues at Christmas for the mince pies are four blocks long. Peter's famous. Peter actually catered a couple of Rolling Stones New York gigs. And Keith lives in Connecticut now, and Keith and Peter have become friends. So every time Keith gets home to the States, the first thing he does is go to Myers of Keswick, and he and Peter sit down over a china pot of tea, and they have a cup of tea, and they chew the cud. And to this day, Keith always sends Peter a crate of wine at Christmas time, but it's not any old wine. It's a Cabernet Sauvignon, and it's got a Rolling Stones lapping tongue logo on it, the label. Collector's items.
Right. Which they famously paid about £10 to the designer for, didn't they?
John Pash, who was my boss at Chrysalis Records. John Pash, when he was an art student, was paid, I think, about £85 for his designs for the most famous logo, let alone rock and roll logo, the most famous logo in the world. And years later, because he was then art director at Chrysalis, we used to tease the hell out of him and say, John, come on, you know, you got 85 quid. They're making millions out of this. Look at the merchandise. Oh, yeah, I suppose maybe I should have tried to get a bit more. So he took them to court, and I think he got about £7,000. And the Stones are laughing, you know. This is Mick, the most parsimonious man on earth. So it turned around because some years later, John was moving house. He found in his attic the original drawings, the sketches that he'd first shown Mick Jagger, which he sold to the V&A for enough money to put his son through private school.
There's a lot of people doing this at the moment, going through their souvenirs, finding an original Don McLean.
Don McLean, every 20 minutes. He found the original
American Pie,
and that sold for something like $1.3 million. Weirdly, the next day, he said he'd gone through another room and he'd found all sorts of lyrics. You know?
So He's had a tax bill, that's what's happened.
So there's all sorts of business.
No, there's a good story there. I just jump in because Jim Hutton, who was Freddie's boyfriend, yeah, we mentioned earlier, Freddie gave Jim the original lyrics to Bohemian Rhapsody. And after Freddie died, they all had a little trunk in the house with their personal belongings in. And unfortunately, all the men who lived at Garden Lodge, Freddie's house, they were all kicked out quite rapidly. They were supposed to be allowed to live there until they could find somewhere else to live, but that isn't what happened. And we won't name names, but it didn't happen. So they were all forced to leave quite quickly, and Jim never got his trunk back. So wherever that trunk is, the original lyrics to Bohemian Rhapsody are in there.
Wow. Think of the final closing shot of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's somewhere in there. You've got to find it. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll have an interval there. Leslie Ann Jones.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.